Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Committee on Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy to order. Members, as usual, please mute your mics. This remote hearing is conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can be viewed at House Television webcast. With that, the Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Badri, will now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor present. Vice Chair Zhang. Vice Chair Zhang. Lead Hamilton.
Present.
Lead Hamilton present. Baker.
Baker present.
Baker present. Dabney. Dabney. Frankie.
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Greenman.
Greenman present.
Greenman present. Haley.
Haley present.
Haley present. Juergens.
Juergens present.
Juergens present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Katiza Watun.
Katiza Watun present.
Katiza Watun present. Olson.
Present.
Olson present. Jean.
Zhang T present.
Zhang present. Vice Chair Zhang.
Zhang J present.
Vice Chair Zhang present. Baker. Baker.
For Dabney. Representative Baker already checked in. So it circle back to Dabney.
Oh, Dabney.
Dabney present.
Dabney present. Chair Noor, we have a quorum.
There's a quorum present. I will now entertain a motion to approve the minutes for February, I believe, 2nd, 2022.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson moves the approval for minutes of February 2nd, 2022. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? See none, the motion prevails, and minutes for February 2nd, 2022 are now approved. With that, members, today we do have an important conversation that we've been having for the past 2 years when we were hit by the pandemic. We understand that there were some challenges that were presented with the unemployment benefits. And before we go into the details, this will be an informational hearing. And everyone who's been welcome to testify today on this important topic will be allowed 2 to 3 minutes. And I would like to turn over to the Commissioner for Deed, Commissioner Grove. Please welcome again to the committee and proceed with the discussion on this important topic.
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Noor. Hello, everybody. Members of the committee, happy Monday. Hope you're all well and staying warm. We're honored to be here. Again, just to kick off this conversation that the chair has invited to take place on unemployment insurance, and in particular, the chair asked us just to kind of set the storyline on exactly how unemployment insurance works and the situation that we face, that we're all operating from kind of the same understanding of where we are in Minnesota right now as we begin this important discussion. I'll ask my colleague, Daryl Dannon, to pull up the slides that I believe you have all been circulated. Actually, Devin Badri from Deed is gonna walk through these with me. And I'm joined today by Acting Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services, Evan Rowe, who will also walk through some of the details about how unemployment insurance taxes work. So an important discussion as we look at ways we can tackle this issue for small businesses across the state. So I'll kick us off just by beginning a little bit of an overview of what unemployment insurance is and how it works. Many of you know this, but I think it's helpful to just remind ourselves. Devin, if we can go to the next slide here. The basics are Minnesota Statutes 268.03, and unemployment insurance is created really to provide for the public good by helping workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own to get a temporary partial wage replacement to assist unemployed workers as they become reemployed. This is one of the oldest programs in the country, oldest social service programs that exists. It was created in Washington by the federal government, but every state administers it slightly different within those federal statutes that guide the broader program. And so while states have some leeway to tailor their programs to their state, We do, of course, operate under the broader federal guidelines of the UI program. The eligibility for UI, as you all know, is focused on those who are laid off, again, by no fault of their own. And that includes if you quit or were discharged where the worker did not cause their own unemployment. It's a temporary benefit in normal times of up to 26 weeks, so half of a year. And it doesn't pay out your full wage that you lost by getting out of the workforce, but it does cover half of that wage up to a max of $820. And that rate is figured out via statute based on average wages across the state. But it's either half your wages or a max of $820 per week. And while you're getting that benefit, we ask that workers be able to work, available to work, and actively seeking work in our economy. So there has to be action towards getting off of the program as you're receiving those benefits. Now, UI is funded entirely through a trust fund that is funded by a state payroll tax that Minnesota employers pay into the system. So it's designed to have that trust fund there that can be on tap when things get more challenging in our economy. That payroll tax is paid every quarter. And there are two different types of employers in the state. We'll get to this a little bit more in detail later, but there are those who pay taxes to fill the system, and then there are those, a very small number, nonprofits, schools, hospitals, and the like, who are reimbursing employers. They pay into the system when they need it, but not as an always-on tax model. The U.S. Treasury holds that trust fund, and it can only be used for unemployment insurance benefits. States can't pass laws to use it for other things. It is there simply for the payment of those benefits. So that's the basics of how the system works. And then, of course, this system we've had around for 80 years in our country was suddenly put under incredible stress when COVID hit. And we all remember the headlines and the challenges that states across the nation faced with unemployment insurance and the huge spike in those who applied. We saw in our state a huge influx in applications for unemployment insurance. By the end of the whole pandemic period of time for UI, about one in five Minnesotans had applied for unemployment insurance. Your friends, your neighbors, people you know well, I'm sure everyone here knows someone who applied and received those benefits. Many people who never thought they'd access this program in a million years were suddenly drawing down checks because they had to step aside from work, especially in those early few months of the pandemic when the whole country was trying to get a handle on what exactly COVID was and what it meant for the workplace. The legislature and the governor, if you go back to that slide, did a lot of things early to make sure UI would work for people. They limited a waiting week so you could get paid right away. We suspended eligibility requirements to let more people be access the program. For example, the self-employed or those who are not your typical W-2 employees. We expanded our shared work program to let folks do some work and get some benefits. And we relieved charges in those situations in which COVID was the reason you were out of a job. Now, that was really critical because we were able to hold employers harmless here for the fact that this cataclysmic event had hit our state. And then, of course, we had a bunch of federal programs that came into play. Extra money per week, we all know that. Extended program to go longer than usual for unemployment insurance. A new benefit program to help those who don't usually get covered. We even ended up tapping into FEMA dollars as a nation to pay for certain weeks of extra benefits. All of this a critical part of the pandemic response, and I am grateful to the staff and leaders in our unemployment insurance department here in the state because Minnesota was one of the fastest states in the country at responding to getting these federal programs up and running. Many of you have seen the lines around the block that happened in other states. That just didn't happen in Minnesota, broadly speaking, and we had the fastest rate of any state in the country of getting all three of those federal programs in place. So we're able to move quickly, and as you go to the next slide, you'll see just how much of an increase in benefit applications you see in our state when COVID hit. That blue line, of course, is 2020. The lines of those are below our previous years. You saw upticks during bad times, but this is really an unprecedented spike that we saw in our state in a really challenging time for Minnesota. So just to put this in perspective, you know, by the numbers, the COVID response for UI ended up with 1.35 million applications for benefits. Devin, if you go to the next slide, about 873,000 applicants received at least one payment of unemployment insurance. In total, almost $15 billion out the door of deed into the pockets of Minnesotans during this time. That money not only made it sure that those workers could provide for their families, but it also kept money circulating in the economy. At one point, from a federal dollars perspective, we were pulling about $100 million a week into the state in federal dollars only as additional payments to Minnesotans, and that really kept the economy moving at a time when so much else was challenging. So a really important program at an important juncture in our state. And I want to get our team to give you a little more specifics about how the taxes work here, because that's a critical piece of what we do next. And for that, I'll turn to my colleague, Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services, Evan Rowe.
Thanks, Commissioner Grove.
Welcome, Deputy Commissioner. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My name is Evan Rowe, Acting Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services here at DEED, and I'm here to talk just a little bit about the unemployment insurance tax structure. These slides, let's just say they're a little busy, so I'm not going to read every bullet point here, but hopefully it's a useful leave behind for members of the committee, and I'll go quickly through these slides because I know we don't have a ton of time, but obviously I'm happy to answer any questions or dive deeper on any of these individual points. So there's really five pieces of the state's UI tax structure, and I'm just going to cover each piece of them in brief as a sort of a summary level, and happy to answer any questions as we go through. The first thing to remember is that the one doesn't pay UI taxes on the entire basis of an employee's salary. There's a taxable wage base, similar in the same way to like the federal Medicare limit, where only the first $38,000 of an employee's salary or wages are taxed in a given year. So that this number is pegged to the taxable annual or the average annual wage in the state. On this wage base, then, there's a couple pieces that are generally always on as part of the overall UI tax structure. The first is the base tax rate, and this is a tax rate that's paid by every taxpaying employer at the same rate. The rate is between 0.1% and 0.5%, and this one is linked to the status of the UI trust fund. When the UI trust fund is lower, the tax rate is higher. When the trust fund is higher, the tax rate is lower. It's meant to be a self-correcting mechanism in that regard. Additionally, there's something called the experience rate. And experience rates are based on, they're set similarly to insurance premiums. They're higher for those employers that use the system more, that see more layoffs and therefore draw from the unemployment insurance program. Unemployment insurance is required to be experience rated by the federal government in the sense that businesses that use the system more are expected to pay more. So what this means is that in Minnesota, businesses can have an experience rate varying from 0% to 8.9%, again, on that taxable wage base. And then it's applied across all those businesses' employees. I'll just note that 2022 rates are nearly identical to 2020. The legislature instructed, and the governor signed legislation, that it basically instructed DEED to hold experience rates harmless as to the results of the pandemic. So I just wanted to note that. That's an application of executive order and session law. Next slide, please. So in years when the UI trust fund is not in as financially strong a position, there are a couple other mechanisms that are activated called the additional assessment and the special assessment. The additional assessment is a surtax that's applied to the amount owed by an employer after the base and experience ratings are applied. And this is really meant to help the UI program, the UI trust funds, kind of automatically recover in the wake of a downturn. There's four different rates that are triggered at different tax threshold or different UI trust fund thresholds. And these are all set and determined by the status of the trust fund as of March 31st of the prior year. For calendar 2022, that rate is 14%, and it's the same for every business. Additionally, the special assessment is another surtax that is used to help pay for the interest. So when the state borrows from the UI from the federal UI trust fund, this is basically the mechanism that allows us to pay the interest on that borrowing. This is set in consultation between Commissioner Deed and Commissioner of MMB, and it's really just used for that interest service. It was 4% in 2021. It's 1.8% in 2022, in large part because the overall balance of funding. Next slide, please. So then we just wanted to provide a little bit more context around where the UI Trust Fund has gone as we've sort of gone through the pandemic. And we also wanted to provide a little bit of historic perspective as to show you how the UI Trust Fund really has kind of gone up and down, going all the way back to 2008 and the Great Recession. So on the next slide, you'll see the when I mentioned earlier that it's meant to be a sort of self-regulating program in many ways, that's what this is. You see that in 2008 and 2009, you start to see the UI Trust Fund get drawn down, kind of dipping, I think it was about $750 million in deficit, right around the peak in 2011. And then the series of additional tax increases brought the trust fund slowly back up to a more stable position by 2014, 2015. 2015 through 2019, 2020, it was staying more or less the same. Again, it's designed to be self-regulating. The additional tax rates turned off, and the trust fund more or less hovered around the same rate. And then you can see in 2020, with the onset of the pandemic, the impact that had on the overall trust fund position declined substantially. And you'll see over the obviously in 2021, 2022, it's kind of hovered around negative $1.3 billion. You'll notice that there's there's kind of spikes in this. That's because we receive UI taxes on a quarterly basis, so there's a bit of seasonality in there. Next slide, please. So the question is, how do advances from the federal government work? So when a state's trust fund goes into deficit, the state draws money from the treasury, and this is called a Title 12 advance. It works like a line of credit. I think the way to think about it is like a home equity line of credit, or it's overdraft protection on your checking account. It's secured against the future state UI and federal tax receipts. And on a particular day when benefit payments exceed receipts, borrowing occurs. I want to note that this is not uncommon in a downturn. It isn't unusual for states to borrow during a downturn. That tends to be what happens when a large-scale economic event happens. There's sort of a national impact, and indeed many states borrowed throughout the pandemic, as they did during the Great Recession. And then repayment back to the trust to the U.S. Treasury occurs when receipts exceed benefit payments over time. Interest on the next slide. Interest is charged monthly, and that's based on the average daily balance for the month. Interest is set by Treasury, and it varies. It's set slightly above prime. It's about 1.59% right now. And Treasury sends the UI program a bill for interest at the end of each month. Interest was waived by Congress from March 2020 through September 2021, but this wasn't extended after the end of the federal programs in September of 21. And I'll just note, interest can't be paid with trust fund money. It has to be paid with state funds, but one of those state funds that can be implemented is the special assessment that I noted earlier. And then the last slide that we have today is just what some other states have done. As I mentioned, several states have borrowed from the U.S. Treasury, and also some have used some of their CARES and ARPA funding to either repay or otherwise kind of help their UI programs overall. California and Connecticut have devoted some funding to UI, but they haven't repaid their Title 12 advances. Other states have basically repaid their Title 12 advances, but at this point haven't paid additional back to the trust fund. Others have paid Title 12 advances back, as well as restocking their UI trust fund. Different states have different financial structures, and many states are having this very conversation right now as we're exiting, hopefully exiting the financial impacts of a pandemic. But we just wanted to provide a little bit of that additional context for you this afternoon. And with that, I think I can turn it back over to you, Chair Noor and Commissioner Grove.
Thank you so much, Deputy Commissioner. Commissioner Grove?
No, Chair, I think that's the extent of our presentation. Just wanted to begin this conversation with some grounding and eager to answer any questions folks might have.
I see the first hand up, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate the update again. I probably said it a bunch of times. You guys really were heroes and did a nice job on this early on. Seeing your normal money coming through of $800 million up to $15 billion. Holy smokes, what a feat that must have been. So we're all considering whether we should take this money that we've got in our surplus and ARP funds and all those things. And if we didn't do that, Commissioner, how long would it take us to replenish that fund that is so low right now? Do we have any estimates if we were to not do that, how long would it take us to pay that back?
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, it's a great question. If we allowed the system to do as it is set up to do and just increase taxes and pay it off over time, it's going to take about another decade to replenish the fund if we didn't do anything.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, just one more. And what would the average increase be to the UI tax for most businesses that it would face if they had to repay this? So in a matter of those automatic adjustments, is it just that 0.5, but it's also taking those special assessments into consideration too. So do we have kind of an estimate as to what an average business would be paying back, or is any idea?
Yeah.
Commissioner Grove.
Mr. Chair, President Baker, it's a good question. Of course, there is no average business. It really depends on the size of the business and, of course, the wage rate that you pay your workers, whether they're full-time or part-time. And so you can kind of run the model based on what assumptions you want to make on the size of business and otherwise. Broadly speaking, we found that when we look at sort of what the average increase might be, it's in the realm of about 30% higher unemployment insurance taxes moving forward than it would be if we didn't do anything. So that has varying levels of impact. And again, there's no one answer to that question, but on average, roughly a third of a hike on your existing tax bill is what we would expect.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Frank.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Commissioner Grove and Mr. Rowe for the great presentation and explanation. I'm holding one of my notices right here, and I was kind of wondering what the 14% was on the additional assessment. So now I can pass that along. I'm just kind of wondering, when do we need to act? When does the legislature need to act and get this to the governor and get his signature on it in order to get the information out to the businesses so they can update their systems, so you guys can update your systems, and we can move forward and put this behind us?
Commissioner Gore.
March 15th. March 15th is the day after which we would not be able to halt the billing of employers for these increased taxes. We've, of course, notified them already, as you just reminded us with your letter, so folks know this is coming. But if we don't get this taken care of by March 15th, then we can't stop the billing process that would click into gear.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Commissioner Grove. Thank you, Chair Noor. No more questions.
Representative Juggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all remember last year, House leadership chose to delay acting on state income taxes on PPP proceeds and unemployment benefits, and that resulted in many Minnesotans having to file amended returns. Thinking along those lines, what would be the process if we don't act on this? Would employers end up having to pay in, and then if we do act, do they get refunds? Just can you walk us through what that might look like?
Commissioner Grove.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to turn to my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe, please.
Chair Noor, Representative Juergens, thank you for that question. And I think it would be an, I guess, unparalleled circumstance in many ways in that the statutory deadline for businesses to pay their Q1 tax is April 30th for this current year. So if action wasn't taken, then basically all these businesses would have submitted their tax. And then if action was then taken after, then there would, one, have to be a huge amount of backwards reconciliation that would have to be done, which would be extremely complex and just administratively exceptionally difficult. It would create major problems, I would say, for kind of the business experiences in terms of how folks would be kind of experiencing their interaction. And it would also just be, it would take our agency, it would be an unprecedented effort for us to have to do this, to do that kind of evaluation. Again, that's why we've said March 15th really needs to be the day, because we don't want businesses paying, you know, paying in at a higher rate and then having to kind of back all those extra payments back out. It would be extremely difficult and administratively complex and cumbersome for businesses to for that to happen.
Chairman, I would just add to that. Dr. Rose is absolutely right. It really kind of depends what the legislature decides to do, right? If the legislature decides that it will pass this later and then go back, that's the process that would take place. If the legislature just passes it, you know, full stop, then you'd have paid a couple of quarters of taxes and we'd move forward. So it kind of depends on how the legislature would navigate that moment.
Representative Jones, right? I know I've got some few questions the same line. Go ahead.
Yeah, nothing further. Just it appears that it's essential that we move quickly. Thank you.
Representative Greenman, I know I'll wait for my time to ask the same questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for you, Commissioner Grover or Mr. Rowe. But you described the system as self-regulating. And I know that we've seen over time that the sort of taxes fluctuate back and up and down based on the size of the trust fund. And I'm wondering if you can sort of explain sort of when the trust fund is higher, where the taxes are, and sort of how that impacts where we are today.
Deputy Commissioner. Oh, Commissioner Gore, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine to pass this one to my colleague, Evan. I think he can explain this well.
Thank you, Chair Newark. Representative Greenman. So generally speaking, I think when we were back on, you know, call it back in the period from 2016 to 2019 before the onset of the pandemic, you saw the base rate around at the 0.1% mark. So basically at the lowest threshold of the base tax rates. And these additional assessments were completely off. Statutes 268.051 outlines it's all prescribed in statute as to exactly what the trigger points are. It's tied to the percentage of total covered wages in employment. So essentially you run the numbers and you see where you are, and that determines what the tax rate is. But again, when the trust fund is at a healthy level, you're down at the 0.1% base tax rate and no additional assessments.
And just sure, if I could just follow on that, the number everyone here should know is 1.3 billion. When we are in a positive 1.3 billion status in our trust fund, all those additional taxes turn off. And so that's why the governor's recommendation is 2.73 billion. It's both to dig us out of the hole that we know we'll be in and are in right now, and then get us up to 1.3. After 1.3, all those taxes that maybe Commissioner Rowe just walked us through would no longer be levied.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate those comments, because I think what I'm trying to figure out is, so it's a self-regulating system, and I think we've designed it that way. And to your point, I think it has really been, we all, I think on this committee and in the state of Minnesota, know how important these benefits have been, how important your work has been in ensuring that Minnesotans have access to the unemployment that they need. And I think what we're talking about right now is whether we're going to intervene in that self-regulating system and who that's going to sort of impact. And one of the things I'm wondering, if and I know you said we can't, it's hard to sort of that no two businesses are alike. But when we think about how we're intervening, one of the things I know we have been talking a lot about is making sure that we're targeting our resources towards the businesses, the industries, and the workers that have been hardest hit. So we know that the hospitality industry, we know that there's a set of industries that have really been hit. And we also know that there's a set of industries like retail, you know, I think Walmart had their best year ever, Amazon, that have actually made and really been thriving and made. And so I'm wondering if you could tell us sort of, as we think about how we're going to intervene in the system, is there a way that we can ensure that we're really helping and targeting our work to the businesses and the industries and the workers that have been most impacted by this. I think what we'd all agree is this pretty unique situation that requires us potentially to intervene.
Commissioner Gruhr.
Chair Noor, Representative Greenman, it's a great question. And I think one important thing to share here, when I talked earlier about how there's federal statutes and state statutes that guide our program, one of the federal statutes that guides unemployment insurance is that you can't target particular businesses by size or industry with different tax rates just based on their size or their industry. So we couldn't, for example, say if you're an employer of over 500, you don't pay additional taxes, but if you're under, you do, or vice versa, or whatever the construction might be. So we aren't given that leeway, and no state is, to moderate it, accordingly. I can tell you that back in the napkin, when we look at the impact of these tax rates and just the size of businesses in Minnesota, about 70% of the businesses in our state that would see tax increases if we don't erase this deficit are businesses of under 500 people. And what you often find when you look at this from an industry perspective is it's the trades who are affected the most because they're seasonal. And so you think about the construction trades and what have you, they're seasonal. So they already sort of are in the system a lot deeper because they rely on it more as workers come on and off their payrolls. So broadly speaking, from an industry mix perspective, you've got a lot of trades who I think are more affected by the UI system than the other business types. But again, it really, there's so many other factors in terms of business size and usage of the system that that vary. But that ability to sort of do this specifically for one group or another is not within our power.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate that. And I appreciate that the system is really set up to ensure that we're not sort of distinguishing between different types of workers and different industries, and that's where the federal and state policy is. I think for policymakers, then the question is, what tools are we using when we're talking about how we really respond to this this pandemic that we know has not hit all businesses or in all industries the same? And so I think that may be a policymaking of which solutions we're pursuing to make sure that we are really targeting our resources. So I really appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I know I have a few questions in regards to the UIP. So thank you so much, Commissioner, for the presentation, Deputy Commissioner Rowe. When we passed the first bill, last year, Senate File 192, because the system is supposed to be self-correcting, we decided that we need to hold back the taxable wage base to $35,000, which in essence, it created us to increase the debt, if that's how I perceive to be, because it will have gone to $37,000, which will have increased the number of payment into the trust fund. Is that correct? Because this is a self-regulating system or self-correcting system that will have taken care, reduced the debt. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're asking about the taxable wage base and how that was adjusted in that piece of legislation.
Correct. So what I'm trying to put it into perspective is when we enacted that bill, in essence, we took care of the experience rating because many businesses will have seen that triple up and they'll have been paying higher experience rating. At the same time, we reduced the taxable wage base to back into what it was in 2020, which was $35,000. And now when you look at this year, because of the evaluation of the average wage, which was done by June 30th of the last year, it's now $38,000 because it's a self-correcting system, and it looks at different models for that purposes. There's almost an 8% increase, which is a natural increase process. Is that the appropriate assessment from that perspective? I see, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. I'd just say briefly, and Evan, please add here anything you'd like. Yes, we naturally increase tax and wage base just because they're trying to pay that half the paycheck up to a max of 820 every year. So we want to get that right. There needs to be enough money in the trust fund to do that. The bill you're referring to that we passed was done, of course, during the pandemic time to prevent impacting businesses. And so at that moment, when we calculated what the taxable wage base was, it was 35,000. And so we set it in that particular piece of legislation because of who we were. But every year we come back to this. And as we all know, wages have gone up a lot over the last year. And so that taxable wage base did increase. Deputy Commissioner Rowe, would you add anything to that?
Just that the calculation for the taxable wage base is defined in statute. So for this year, basically, we went back to it's essentially indexed to the average annual wage within the state. I believe it's 60% of that. So for this year, it went back to that calculation, which is why you see the increase this year.
So thank you so much, Deputy Commissioner. If we keep the base wage, which is now 38,000, and knowing that's the natural process of self-correcting or the wages that we see, because we want to make sure that we have a healthy account. And the question now I have is, what's the actual debt that we have from Title 12 that is in the books as of today? Knowing that the first quarter payment is by the end of April, what is the actual number that we have?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to pull up the numbers as we talk here, but I think as of right now, it's around 1.3. But we calculate that by the next time we have to make the next tax payment, so because you can make these payments quarterly, Treasury bills us, it'll be up to 1.53 billion. So That is the calculation that we made. When you add 1.3 to that, you start to see where our math netted out. So 1.53 billion in debt by our next tax payment is kind of the number that we should focus on.
I'll make it brief. So Commissioner, thank you for that response. According to the Title 12 advance, it's $1.2 billion, knowing that there are a few months that we'll be paying into for the month of March and April. What is the total anticipated collection for the first quarter, which is usually the largest collection of the UI, tax?
Mr. Chair, I think that number you cited is actually a couple weeks late, so we'll get back to you with the most recent one. I think it's around $1.245 billion as of last week, is what I'm seeing. But again, it depends on, it has that cyclical nature to it. On the second question, Deputy Commissioner, do you have an answer to that, or do we need to get back to the chair?
I think it would be better to get back. I want to make sure that we have the exact right number down.
So the reason why I'm asking is we can pay the debt, remove the experience rating from going up, which we've already taken care of, remove the additional assessment, and also the special assessment, which is the 14%. And 1.8%, at the same time pay the interest. But because this is a self-correcting system, if we move from that level, not knowing the requirement for the balance for the unemployment trust fund, we will be above zero. That means it goes to 0.4% base tax. We're taking care of businesses. We will discuss more later on into the bill. Because we know there are many issues that we have to take care of during the session. But what we're proposing in terms of the conversation is to pay the debt, pay the interest, make sure that there are no additional assessment at all. At the same time, make sure that the payment done is correct for the businesses by making sure that the self-correcting system will take care of itself. That's something which we're looking into. We'll have that conversation later on, but I see, I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, Commissioner Grove. I see Lead Hamilton hands raised.
Well, Mr. Chair, just briefly, I would say, I just want to go back to the math the department has done over several months on this, that unless we get up to $1.3 billion in our trust fund, taxes will go up for employers, and that includes the additional assessment. And so that has to happen to get us to the level we are. And we can share with the group here kind of a chart of how this happened under the conditions of the Great Recession to see how the additional assessment stayed turned on during that period of recovery. But those taxes didn't go away just because we got to zero. And that's why we advocate for moving $2.73 billion of the surplus into this account.
Just on that question, so we don't come back to that question, Commissioner. If we pay the debt, it's about zero. And by law, we remove any additional, because we'll take care of the special assessment, we'll pay the interest for that is accruing right now. Will that not be the best option to go forward to remove any additional assessment? Because we want to make sure that we take care of business. They don't see that 14%, 1.8%. At the same time, because we're putting more resources in, there will be no credit, the future credit reduction, which will happen if we don't do anything at this moment. Is that something that we're willing to discuss and debate and come up with the best option going forward?
Mr. Chair, we getting only to zero would still require us to increase taxes. We have to pay benefits. Like, we have to still pay people on unemployment insurance. And if we have zero money in the account to do so, then we're not going to be able to do so. So, like I said, we do have to raise taxes to get the trust fund up to level 1.3 if we want to have normal time tax rates. And we didn't go through FUTA in the presentation. It's a federal penalty, essentially, if you're in debt. So, yes, FUTA would go away at zero. But those additional assessments and increased taxes can't just be legislated out and stay at zero and have a trust fund that works. And I wonder, Deputy Commissioner Rowe, if you want to add any context to this.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Noor, thank you. I'll note, the base tax rate is interesting in that it does go down to 0.4% when it hits zero, but the additional assessment still stays on at varying levels until you reach that 1.3, that 1.3 billion level, right? I think it would be at about 14% until you hit at least, I want to say, 700 million. Then it goes down to 10%. Then it goes down to 5%. And then it finally goes down to zero at about a $1.3 billion positive balance. And again, I think part of the idea here is that you want to have enough in the trust fund for it to be able to weather any unexpected, any unexpected downturns. And that's sort of that's why the additional tax rates still stay on, even if you're at zero, because you need to get up to a sustainable level so that you can continue to pay benefits. We estimate that if it was at, even if the trust fund was brought up to zero, it would still take about 5 to 6 years until all those additional assessments and base tax rates would be turned off, and the trust fund would be back to its kind of a steady state around $1.3 billion. And it's worth it. Oh, I'm sorry.
I appreciate that. I know it has to stay at 0.4 until we are almost close to the solvency to remove any increases in the base tax. So that's why we select and say, because of the natural correction process, during the need, we go, down, and then we do it because of the economy is going up. We anticipate that this will be paid in a shared process. So with our, the way that I'm looking at it, major big companies are going to receive the largest savings compared to someone who's almost a small employer, given that the fact that we're paying into the trust fund at that level. The payment from smaller businesses is going to be lower than compared to large big business corporations, quite frankly, because of the struggles. I've had many struggles from many industries who have been left out, who are struggling because of the pandemic. Some businesses are doing really great. So how do we make sure that we tackle that issue at the same time by utilizing the funds that we have? That's the perspective that we're looking at personally in looking into this fund. So I don't want to take much of the, I know Representative Hamilton had his hand raised for a while, so I wanted to give him the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question, Commissioner, how much money are we paying every day on the debt for interest?
Commissioner Gore.
I guess, Mr. Hamilton, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I haven't done the math by day, I guess. We certainly could try to map that out by doing some division. But we are paying that special assessment every quarter to pay the interest on the debt. And again, we have to levy that as an extra tax because you can't use the trust fund itself to pay interest on the trust fund. So that's why that extra special assessments is levied. But in terms of what that equates to on a daily basis, I'd have to get back to you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, if you could, please, because this is substantial, and I just want to know that number and stress the importance on why we need to pass this right away. Mr. Chairman, my second question, it goes to what you had just talked about, and then also Representative Greenman, about that we can't pick and choose businesses, who's going to benefit, who's going to not, around this, because like it was pointed out, the federal law treats everyone fairly. And again, so I just want to make sure that we all understand that, not get caught up in the empty rhetoric around that. We are prohibited, if you will, from picking winners and losers on this. So we just need to make sure that we all understand that, too, as we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Lead Hamilton. Representative Haley, before we proceed with the bill's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my questions were cleared up in the previous discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, I wanted to welcome Representative Kali Kutizotun to your committee, and please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for including House File 3000 in the important discussion on unemployment insurance and worker supports today. This proposal is a two-part bill. First, as the administration has proposed, it will allocate $2.73 billion from the general fund to the UI Trust Fund. Essentially, this provision attempts to minimize the impact of the pandemic to the UI Trust Fund as a whole. So it's an important step in the COVID-19 recovery process for Minnesota businesses. And while we know that the pandemic certainly has hit workers and small businesses harder than some other businesses, this $2.73 billion number will both erase the current deficit in the trust fund as well as replace the funds that were used to assist workers throughout the pandemic. As Commissioner Grove mentioned earlier, one in five, so 20% of Minnesota workers drew on unemployment insurance funds over the past 2 years. And to me, this showcases just how important social safety nets are to the people of Minnesota. Next, and this is my favorite part, this proposal takes action on the longstanding exclusion of hourly school employees from the state's unemployment insurance program. It has been in the works for some time, and in fact, House leadership highlighted this priority at the very beginning of the pandemic, but we were not able to find agreement on passage. Last year, we heard and moved House File 1054 from Representative Greenman in this committee, and this change will grant tens of thousands of bus drivers, paraprofessionals, educational assistants, lunchroom staff, and others the same access to unemployment benefits that other Minnesota workers have when they become unemployed. As you may know, I'm a mom of four kids here in Eden Prairie, and three of my children are currently attending Eden Prairie Public Schools. They ride the bus, they eat school lunch, they benefit from amazing support and instruction from paraprofessionals and educational assistants. Here, I must give a shout out to Mr. Dick, the wonderful bus driver who picked up my four-year-old for her preschool program every day at the end of our driveway last year, and to bus driver Dave, who has safely driven my boys' route for the past 3 years. The incredible work that they and other folks do impacts children and families all across the state of Minnesota. This policy not only helps these workers, but also school districts by providing a more stable workforce. We have teachers and administrators filling in the lunchroom to make sure our children are fed. There are districts across the state and here in the metro who have had to shut down their busing programs due to staffing challenges. When our schools lose staff, our children lose caring and important adults in their lives. In contrast to the massive impact that these folks have on our communities, they are often underpaid and living paycheck to paycheck. This workforce is majority female and often people of color. They deserve the same security that as all other workers in the state of Minnesota. It's not only the fair thing to do, it is the right thing to do to ensure that these workers have equal access to our social safety net so that they are able to provide for their families and continue to do the work that they do for our kids too. I've received tremendous insight and support from my constituents and workers in the Eden Prairie schools on this issue, including Liza Anderson, who is here today to testify. And I am so proud to include this provision in House File 3000. And I would now like to turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you so much, Liza Anderson. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sorry, I had to unmute. Sorry. My name is, it's actually Lisa, but it's spelled Liza Anderson. And I'm a special ed paraprofessional. And I've actually been wanting to work on changing this for a while because I during the pandemic, I was scrambling when I lost my summer position at the school district. I was scrambling trying to find other work after I found out that I couldn't collect unemployment. And it was very difficult because I'm a mom of four. I'm the head of the household. I'm a single mom. And I work at a big box retail store. And I was not able to pick up position or extra hours there. And I found myself delivering groceries over that summer, which was a blessing. But I was putting myself, my children's health, and at risk, plus my employment at risk, because I was out there, you know, having to pick up extra hours. And one of the things that I think that we need to realize is most paraprofessionals and lunch ladies are not dual income anymore. A lot of them are head of household, single parents, and we rely on this income. And when something like this pandemic happens, it really puts into perspective of how it needs to be changed that we are able to accept unemployment. And one of the things is most of us do have second jobs. We do work summers no matter what. It's not like there would be a ton of us all of a sudden collecting unemployment every summer. It's just a safety net for some of us. And without my income at the school, it puts me and my children's housing and everything in great jeopardy.
Thank you so much, Ms. Anderson. Representative Cortez-Otun, did you want to call the next person? I see Ms. Webster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, we will take it over to Jessica Webster with Legal Aid. And Lisa, I apologize for mispronouncing your name. It happens to me too often, and I wanted to just call that out and apologize.
Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. I don't see her in
the... Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've not seen her, heard from her yet. So if she comes in, I'll let you know.
We'll go to the next testifier. I have Bill Chuan. Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Chuan. I am a special ed paraprofessional in Bloomington. I am also the president of the Bloomington Federation of Paraprofessionals, and I'm here today to speak in favor of making hourly school employees eligible for unemployment. Educational support for professionals are the individuals that make school happen. We are the professionals who often are the first people that students see in the morning and the last that they see at the end of the day. We transport and serve nutritious meals. We answer phones and clean buildings. We work with our youngest students and those that have the most needs, and we're there to wipe a nose, dry some tears, zip a coat, or simply give a hug when needed. Before the pandemic, ESPs were a necessary part of making school happen. Once COVID became part of our lives, we became essential. Whether it was providing childcare for frontline medical staff or making and delivering take-home meals, cleaning and sanitizing buildings and classrooms, or providing tech support to teachers and students alike so that learning could continue. We were essential. Hourly school workers were on the front lines before it was known how the virus was spread or before there was a vaccine. As we started this school year, it was widely publicized that there was a shortage of many hourly school employees. There are shortages of bus drivers, custodians, food service workers, and paraprofessionals. There's always been a shortage of those important hourly school employees, but the pandemic made the situation worse. There are a number of reasons why there are shortages for these employees, but the biggest reason is pay. Hourly school employees are the lowest paid group of employees in our schools. On top of our low pay, our opportunities to work are limited by the school calendar. We are essentially seasonal workers. We are at the mercy of the school calendar, and when there is no school, there is no pay. I'm aware that unemployment insurance has been depleted over the past couple of years due to the pandemic. I believe the bill I'm here speaking in support of has the means to replenish the unemployment insurance fund while extending unemployment to hourly school workers who need it. While landscapers, resort workers, and many others who work in the trades already have access to UI, you have a chance to help with the recruitment and retention of essential hourly school workers by making them eligible for unemployment insurance. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Schwann. Thank you so much for your testimony. We have one final testifier on this bill. Tina Buckhold, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tina Burkholder. I'm the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools, also a past president of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, or MASBL, and also representing Minnesota School Board Association, or MSBA. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. As a school business official, I oversee the school district's finances and payroll-related benefits and non-instructional type services. In reviewing the proposed bill, I just have a couple items for the legislative members to consider. First, school districts are allowed to levy for unemployment costs to their property tax levy reports each year. The unemployment costs are then transferred to the residents of the community. MASBL and MSBA would support the proposed bill if the state found a way to fund the additional unemployment costs rather than the school districts increasing their property tax levies. I reside in a community that's very conservative, where successful operating referendums are very hard to pass, and we try to maintain our levy where and when we can to continue to build trust with our residents. Another thing to consider is that some school district employees have certain positions that are contracted out, such as bus drivers or food service staff. At Monticello, we contract out our transportation services, so bus drivers are not on our payroll. At a neighboring district, both food service and transportation services are contracted out. So since they are school employees, companies would then have higher unemployment costs, which would then transfer back to the school districts with higher invoices or higher rates. In a time where school districts are constantly trying to maintain budgets, we kindly ask the state to fund the increased unemployment costs that could occur with this proposed change, with no doubt exceptional employees of our district, for those to consider moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Buckholder, for your testimony. I do have one more testifier that we should have included, and I think there are others. Teresa, please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed. Mr. Reese, do you see?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You can hear me. You can't see me, but you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you, Ms. Chapovsky. Please proceed.
Hello, Chair Noor and committee members. I am Teresa Jakubowski, a school bus driver for nine years in District 196. I testified in this committee when unemployment for hourly school workers was a standalone bill. Thank you, Emma Greenman, for authoring that bill. Thank you, Chair Noor, for including us in the jobs bill last year. And thank you for fighting for us in the conference committees. It was quite a blow when the Republican-led Senate removed us from the bill before it passed. I'm back because the bill is as urgent as ever. We have a shortage of bus drivers, paraprofessionals, food service workers, and other hourly workers who keep the schools open and functioning. Even before the pandemic, we suffered through the summer with reduced hours and small paychecks. In a normal year, we drive charters and extra routes during the spring and fall to save up for the summer. Of course, during COVID, there are no charters or extra routes. School workers who have second and third jobs usually work in hospitality and other service jobs that have still not recovered from the pandemic. We love our jobs. We love the kids. Before there was a vaccine, drivers transported essential workers' children to and from daycare. Paraprofessionals were reassigned as daycare workers, where they doubled as teachers. And food service workers made sure our community didn't go hungry. Custodians kept the building clean and safe. We were all exposed to COVID, and many of us got it. I contracted COVID in December of 2020. We had to go to work when most of the state was encouraged to stay home, and we did it because we care. Each summer, since the beginning of the pandemic, there was an exodus of school employees across the state, especially bus drivers. Drivers and other employees found other work and never came back, but I stuck with it. Now, I'm at a breaking point. By the time we dig ourselves out of the hole from the summer, we hit Christmas break and get 2 more weeks without pay. We dig out again, and then we hit spring break. Then it's summer. It goes over and over year after year. We never get ahead, just enough to not fall too far behind when the next school closure hits. Unless we get this sliver, this little sliver of economic security, I'm done. I can't afford to work so hard and still fall behind for another year. Without unemployment insurance after this school year, I'll find work elsewhere. I've already kind of made that decision, but then when I heard that this unemployment bill was being presented, that gave me hope that I could stay in this job. I'm hoping that I'm able to, because I really enjoy it. The task of trying to change the UI law has been going on for years. We are so close, and we have this House of Representatives to thank for working for us. Do not accept any deals that put monies into the pockets of the business owners, but leave out workers like me and thousands of others who care for our state's children. I've spent years testifying, speaking at press conferences, meeting with the governor, and doing everything else in my power to get this bill passed. Make me a believer in the system again and pass this unemployment insurance for school workers with a bipartisan vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jakubowski. And I just wanted to let you know that we did pass in the House, in this committee and also in the House, the hourly school worker UI bill. Unfortunately, we didn't get anywhere. Hopefully, we can get it done this year. We still have one more testifier. They were listed in the wrong bill. So, Kelly Gibbons, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. My name is Kelly Gibbons. I am the executive director of SEIU Local 284, which represents roughly 10,000 school workers across the state of Minnesota. I have a unique story because I've come full circle in the work that I've done. 21 years ago, I filed for unemployment as an hourly school bus driver, because I was too, was a single mom with three children trying to, here's me. We were there filing for unemployment. I couldn't understand how I was a seasonal employee. My work stopped every summer, but I couldn't get unemployment. And I needed that safety net for my children. And I finagled and managed to do the best that I could, but we struggled just like the other testifiers on here today. People don't realize when there's no school, there's no pay. And so it's constantly playing catch up in order to survive. School districts are struggling right now. And I know some of you know that that's happening, but for those of you that don't, our schools are crumbling. And part of the reason is because people have just left from the pandemic. They no longer can afford to stay in these jobs. Some people got unemployment. We fought for unemployment, and some of our members did get unemployment. But there's many of them that were left behind and didn't get it. We tried to help everybody that we could. So not only did I drive a bus for 18 years, I left my employment as a school bus driver because I needed full-time work, or at least enough to pay to support my family. So I started working in construction with Schaefer Construction. I worked for 5 years as a Teamster and a laborer. And I knew every year I was going to be working at the airport. We had secured a position. And so even though I was laid off every winter, I knew I was going to have a job to go back to, was going to be at the airport. And then if I wanted to continue with Schaefer, I knew I would have work somewhere. I just didn't know where. So the trades are always considered when it comes to unemployment. It's mostly a male-dominated group of people. There's a few of us women in there, but not many. And, you know, the state workers, they get unemployment. They do, they file taxes. And I would say it's reasonable to assume that they would have to do taxes every year because we know those are going to come every year. And not that I think the state workers shouldn't get unemployment. I think it needs to be equitable for all workers to get unemployment when their work stops. If there is no work, they should qualify for unemployment. They struggle to find work at other places, and most people do, but most of my members work 2 and 3 jobs. That's the reality of hourly school workers because they're just living paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, we have come for 21 years talking about unemployment and why it's so important. And school districts are struggling. And we believe that unemployment is the solution, not the problem. It is a solution to attract and retain quality employees. If they know that, you know what, there's no work, I can get unemployment, they could still look for other employment if they don't get it, but then at least they have that safety net to continue to come back to the schools year after year. It's time that we make change. These workers deserve it. I know there's people that, you know, have said, well, they can't afford it, you know, and whatever, but it's the cost of doing business. I have a nonprofit business now that I run the union. I pay into unemployment. It's the cost of doing business. You have to take care of your workers. And the workers are looking to the powers that be to say, you know what? You're taking our tax money, billions of dollars, to fund the unemployment compensation fund balance, which, okay, you need to do that. But you need to also make sure that those employees that don't have that opportunity to get unemployment, that they are pulled into the system as well. It's not right. I pay my taxes. I come here to say, you know, it's time to change the situation. The workers are counting on it. And like Teresa said, every single one of my members went into those buildings where others did not go. And they made sure that they took care of the children and the essential workers' kiddos to make sure that they were safe and protected.
Ms. Gibbons, I appreciate
it. It is time for us to protect our workers.
I do want to cut you off. But because of time, if you can.
Can I just say thank you to Emma Greenman? And I wanted to say thank you, Chairman Neuer, also for your dedication to unemployment and the work that you're doing. And sorry, I got long-winded. Have a great day. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you to the bus driver. Any discussion members? Representative Greenman, if you can be brief, and then we'll go ask if the other members with questions. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for the testifiers. I have a quick question, but I don't think it should pass us that in the earlier conversation we talked about, and I heard Representative Hamilton and Commissioner Grove us talk about how our employment system shouldn't pick and choose between companies. I also don't think it should pick and choose between workers. And in this case, it absolutely does. We heard testimony in the last session that food service workers who are paid by private corporations can get unemployment insurance. Food service workers who are paid by school districts can't. And so when we're thinking about the equities of this, we absolutely should say that every worker in Minnesota should be able to have the economic security, and we should not pick and choose. I do have just a quick question for, and I'm not sure if this is for Representative Cotiz Watoon or maybe Ms. Gibbons, but I know in our workforce issues, we've been talking a lot about school bus driver shortages, para shortages, substitute teacher shortages. I'm sure if you're like me, you're hearing about it in your districts from parents and school staff. I'm wondering if someone could just briefly describe how this may help keep those and ensure that we are dealing with those workforce issues so that we have school bus drivers, paraprofessionals, food service folks who can serve our kids.
Representative Grayman, did you have anyone in mind who can respond? Otherwise, I see Chair Dabney, who is well versed in this process, has raised his hand.
Go ahead, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, perhaps if Representative Greenman could rephrase her question, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Representative Greenman.
So I was just asking, I think we've heard a lot about the workforce issues mm-hmm. in our schools, and I know we've heard about them from our constituents. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering just if you can, or maybe Ms. Gibbons or whoever can explain sort of how the economic security of having unemployment insurance for these hourly workers may help us keep and retain these hourly workers.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's in a business setting, you might talk about a double bottom line, Representative Greenman, because I think there's multiple benefits to providing the security for hourly workers that everyone else has. Number one, to this committee's jurisdiction, principally, if I know I can come back in the fall, I'm more likely to come back in the fall. That's just human behavior. If I can support my family through the summer when I'm not getting paid by the school district, I'm more likely to come back in the fall. That's cost savings to school districts because it reduces the amount of training costs and human resource hiring process costs that they have to experience. So the economics piece is there. The other bottom line that I look to is education is a relationship business. And frankly, as the K-12 chair, as a parent, I don't care who that kid has a relationship with. If it's that friendly janitor in the hallway or the school bus driver greeting them in the morning when they get on the bus that starts the day right, that's powerful in making sure there's space in that kid's school for that child. And that is the base for all learning. So we get a double benefit here of, or maybe even triple, more stability for the worker, reduced hiring and training costs for the school district, and a better and warmer school environment for the students. If I may use this as an opportunity to peel off, thank you. But members, we heard in the discussion with the commissioner a sense of urgency about moving on this and bringing in some of the K-12 world. There are statutory requirements about when school districts have to finalize their budgets, and those are coming up as well. So if there is a sense of urgency in the UI trust fund issues that we're looking at today, this also shares that sense of urgency, allowing school districts to set their budgets with full knowledge of the costs and savings that they can project for the next academic year, as well as allowing staff that sense of security as they look forward to the summer and the next fall. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Representative Greenman, thank you for the question.
Thank you both. I see Representative Haley, and then we'll go to the closing remarks from Representative Cotiz Watoon.
Chair, no, I'm just looking at time for this committee, and I think this discussion is not related to the UI trust fund deficit, which is what we're trying to discuss today. So I would respectfully ask that we can move on to other testifiers that are testifying on this issue that was on the agenda for today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hale. We'll come to your bill. I know this is also related to the topic of the UI. It's including paying the deficit based on the recommendations that we had from Representative Cotiz Watoon. Please go ahead and close us on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. I know we're not taking action on these bills today, and it's more of an informational hearing. I appreciate the discussion, all the testifiers, the questions from colleagues, and I do just want to reiterate, you know, how critical it is that we continue to move forward on funding or replenishing the needs in the UI Trust Fund. While we can't pick and choose between businesses, what we can do is choose to support businesses and workers across the state of Minnesota. And I think that there is no better time than now, no better year than this year, with the extraordinary surplus that we have to reinvest in workers across the state of Minnesota and to make sure that everyone gets to come out on the other side of this pandemic stronger than before. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Kutizo Watun. And now to the next bill, we have Representative Haley. Please welcome to your committee, introduce your bill, and proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Representative Haley, before we get started. I think because Representative Haley does have an amendment, we do need to move this bill to be laid over for possible consideration in an omnibus bill if we're going to take up a motion to amend it as well. I just want to make sure that it's properly in front of us rather than just the informational hearing because of the amendment, that's all.
Representative Haley, please proceed.
So would you like to move the amendment first, Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it?
We will go ahead and do that because this is more of informational. I just wanted to let the members know that this will be laid over for possible inclusion. Yes, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Noor. House File 2728 is a solution to addressing the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund deficit. I really appreciate Deed's very thorough explanation earlier in the hearing about all the elements of the UI Trust Fund, so I will not cover that. My amendment brings the bill into alignment with the current figures that Deed is supporting, as well as the governor's office. Replenishing the trust fund deficit and restoring the fund to solvency with $2.73 billion in investment, which comes from both the federal ARP monies and also some from the general fund. In addition, my bill freezes the base rate at 0.1% for 2022. It freezes the special assessment at 0% for 2022. It also freezes the taxable wage base at $35,000. And I'm doing that again because the impact on this trust fund deficit is because of the pandemic, not because of anything that employers caused. So I think that's an important piece to include. And I also include excluding pandemic-related UI claims from an employer's experience rating through 2023. The legislature passed this for 2022 last session, and my bill extends it to 2023.
Representative Haley, did you want to proceed with A2 amendment and so we can put the bill in the shape that you want? So Representative Haley moves A2 amendment, if that's the correct, I'm assuming the correct number. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Seeing none, the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Haley, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to make a brief comment because I really want to get to the testifiers so that they can share their stories today. And my comment is this. I think we have a unique opportunity here. Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, and the governor's office, and the administration, indeed, there is agreement on the number that we need to replenish this fund and restore solvency, the $2.7 billion. And there's also been a lot of discussion around this being a clean bill. Commissioner Grove today talked about the importance of doing this now. We heard lots of comments from Evan Rowe on the impact if we don't do this in a timely manner. And so that's what my bill does. It's a clean bill and aligns with the governor's recommendation and also with very closely with a bill that is moving in the Senate. So I urge us to do this. It is good government. And this is a bill that helps businesses large and small all across the state of Minnesota. And it's a bill that supports workers. If we don't have a UI trust fund that is solvent, we don't have the safety net for folks that become unemployed in the future. And if we don't solve this issue and businesses see a 30% tax increase, that was the the number that Commissioner Grove stated. We impair businesses from being able to hire employees, to be able to give their employees raises, to be able to give their employees expanded benefits. So this bill supports our workers across the state. I will stop with those comments because I have testifiers who have so graciously given up time this afternoon, and I really would like to get to them, if that's okay, Chair North.
Yes, please. Please invite the testifiers, Representative Haley.
Thank you. I believe that Mark Erdahl is waiting to testify. He'd be my first testifier. Mark is the president and CEO of Red Wing Shoe Company.
Mr. Erdahl, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Haley. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Erdahl. I am the president and CEO of Red Wing Shoe Company. Just to give you a little bit of background on Red Wing Shoe Company and how we interact in the state of Minnesota, we are a mid-sized family-owned company founded in 1905. The company is based in Red Wing, Minnesota. We're a manufacturer and retailer and a wholesaler of footwear and workwear. We employ 2,200 employees with businesses in over 100 countries worldwide. We also operate over 700 retail units. In Minnesota, we employ about 1,000 employees, operating 3 manufacturing plants, 5 warehouses, 18 Red Wing shoe stores, and 1 historical hotel, the St. James Hotel. Our corporate headquarters are based in Red Wing. We are the largest employer and giver in the city of Red Wing. We also support 4 labor unions, 3 in the city of Red Wing and 1 in St. Paul. Our number one strategic imperative as a company is to evolve our people and culture. We believe if we get the people and culture thing right, everything else falls into place. We have a profit sharing plan that distributes approximately 1/3 of our operating profit to employees, and every employee participates in that. As a family-owned company, we do not issue stock, and we limit our outstanding debt. As a result, we have a pay-as-we-go philosophy, which means that our investments in people, technology, community, and infrastructure are determined by the cash that we generate. We talked a bit about COVID, so I'd like to tell our story here and how government and company, we came together. So if the beginning of COVID in April 2020 was a dark time for all of us, the uncertainty and fear of COVID was real for us at Red Wing Shoe Company. Within 1 week, our business declined 75%, which was unprecedented in the history of our company. We were shutting down stores. Absenteeism in our factories was 70%. Honestly, employees were afraid. Some had healthcare issues, childcare issues, and we spent millions of dollars to ensure the safety and security of our people and their families. We provided 3 weeks of additional EPTO to every employee. But because of our vertical integration and the sudden impact of our business, it was just not sustainable to go forward in that fashion. So we were forced. We didn't like it, but we furloughed 50% of our workforce. However, we ensured the financial security of every one of our employees through unemployment insurance, and we also retained their company benefits. So combined with these two things, this gave us and a lifeline, us and our employees, a lifeline to return to normalcy in 3 months. And I just say this because I think it's a great example of business and government working together for the common good of all. The impact of the unemployment insurance legislation on Red Wing Shoe Company will directly affect our ability to invest in 2022. And with that, I appreciate your willingness to come together and listen. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for my time here today.
Thank you so much, Representative Haley. Who's next on the list?
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Scott Farrell, who's the president of a company called Down in the Valley. I hope he's back on. I think he got kicked off and was trying to get back in. So, Mr. Farrell, I hope you're there.
Mr. Farrell, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. We only have a few more minutes, and hopefully we can get everything done with all the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if he has made it back on. I did see him come in earlier, so he was on, but I have not seen him. So if he does come back, I'll make sure to bring it to your attention. But yes, he was on earlier and is not currently.
Representative Haley, who's next on the list?
Thank you. I believe John Reynolds with Minnesota NFIB is on next.
Mr. Reynolds, welcome to the committee and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I'm John Reynolds, State Director for National Federation of Independent Businesses Minnesota. NFIB is the largest small business organization in Minnesota with over 10,000 small businesses in every corner of our state. Over three quarters of our members have fewer than 10 employees, and our mission is to advocate for Main Street businesses. First, I'd like to thank Chair Knorr for holding this hearing so quickly on such an important issue for small business. I'd also like to thank Representative Haley and Representative Katiza Wittun for proposing bills to fully repay the UI debt that would otherwise be a drag on small businesses for years to come. A lot of small businesses are struggling right now. In recent NFIB surveys, a third of small businesses report that sales are still well below pre-pandemic levels. Over half have lost sales due to worker shortages, and almost three quarters have lost sales due to supply chain issues. Additionally, over half of small business owners are increasing worker pay, paying more overtime, and working more hours themselves to try to keep up. On top of all that, they're staring down big unemployment insurance tax hikes. A small dental office in Rochester will pay 5.5 times more than last year. A well driller in the West Metro will pay 2.5 times more despite keeping their employees on through the pandemic. Many small businesses who did everything they could to scrape by during the last 2 years say it feels like death by a thousand cuts right now. Thankfully, as Governor Walz and others recognize, the debt that's causing these tax increases was not the fault of small business owners like Democrats and Republicans in other states. They understand the debt was caused by the pandemic and mitigation policies, and the state should help rebuild the UI system. It's clear from NFIB's data that UI tax relief will enable small businesses to continue meeting the challenge at this moment, rebuild their businesses, and invest in their workforce. With regard to the other changes proposed in HF 3000 and the chair's draft bill, we would encourage the committee to have the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council review their impact on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. As the pandemic demonstrated, the UTF is fragile. Broad changes to eligibility could impact UI utilization and UTF depletion, which in turn could impact costs for other employers. Lastly, as the Commissioner Mr. Rowe noted, UI bills are due by April 30th. We hope that lawmakers understand attempts to subdivide repayment will only result in delaying much-needed relief for small businesses, and we also hope that both sides of the legislature will act quickly and not let this become a political football. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. I see Mr. Scott Farrell is back. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. I want to thank you for letting me back in and for the work done by Representative Haley and Representative Katiz Wittun. I'm Scott, General Manager down the Valley. We're a three-store independent chain here in Golden Valley, Maple Grove, and Crystal, Minnesota. I'm also on the board of directors for the Minnesota Retailers Association. We are in our second generation of a family-owned business, and we are generational type business where maybe some on this call have bought records from us when they were young, or maybe still do, and maybe their kids now buy them and things like that. But like everybody else, we were impacted. We average 30 employees in our company and had to obviously shut down for a few months and laid off 27 about of the 30, and of the three left was doing whatever we could to keep business coming in online, as many people enjoyed the fruits of that. But also we have our employees that we had to let go, and we were worried about, you know, how they were going to come out of this. And one of the biggest comforts was hearing when we went into this is do all this and we'll support you, and you will not incur these costs at the end of the day with the UI increases that we feared back at that time. So I was a little shocked when we got the UI tax rate hike, expecting that this would have been thought about a long ago. And with the surplus, obviously, we're hoping that, that can be of help to businesses like our small businesses that are still incurring costs all the time. Our inventory costs, our wages are up. We're paying our employees more, and I think 40% of our payroll is increased, and that is just hourly employees. That is not the salary or the small little upper tier that we have. So fixing the employment fund through the federal estate dollars to help us and all small retailers retailers would help us put in a better position to again keep that money going back to our employees, that we can continue to grow, because their costs, the cost of living is not going down, and we're hearing that from our people all the time. So, you know, my ask is a little bit simple, is just help us get solvent by this, and the plan that has been brought forward, we think is great. And I've never testified like this before in small business, so I appreciate everyone for letting me give my 2 cents. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Members will go for a few more extra minutes to make sure that we have the other testifiers testify on this bill. And so, Representative Haley, I see Andy Wolke as the next testifier. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Wilkie, Director of Business Development and Public Affairs at Greater Mankato Growth, the Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization, serving nearly 1,000 members in Greater Mankato. We're the third largest chamber in the state. We are partners with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce Federation and United for Jobs Coalition. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I want to highlight for you how the Mankato economy is growing and why thoughtful use of state and federal funds can have a major impact on our economy. Our MSA's population is up 21% since 2000. Of the 32 MSAs in the upper Midwest, we have the fourth highest GDP growth, the fourth highest population growth, and the seventh highest job growth. We continue to be a regional hub for a very large trade area. We attract a workforce from an area that includes 22 counties in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. We are a hub for medical care at our regional hospital and clinic systems, education at our five colleges and universities that serve 26,000 students, including the second largest university in Minnesota. Retail, and this is important, we have the highest rate of retail spending per capita, more than all other Minnesota metros. That shows that we draw more consumers from our surrounding areas than all other Minnesota metros. Employment, our daytime employment increases by 40% each day, and agriculture is at the core of our economy. We are the green seam. More soybeans are processed in Mankato than anywhere in North America. In Mankato, hundreds of businesses are still fighting to stay open, keeping people employed and serving customers, just trying to stay afloat. Our economy is stabilizing. However, many businesses are in a precarious position. Efforts should be made to avoid aggravating already challenging headwinds being faced in today's economy, with a historic workforce shortage, an overwhelmed supply chain, and increasing inflation. At Greater Mankato Growth, we support the legislature using existing state and federal funds to repay the state's federal UI loan and bring the fund to solvency. By replenishing the trust fund, businesses can avoid paying the additional assessment surtax of 14% in 2022. If the legislature does nothing and allows these statutory rates to increase, it will result in one regional bank in Mankato with about 130 employees, will see a rate increase of 130% versus that last year, more than $21,000. A local service provider will see a 240% increase from $6,000 to more than $32,000. And a wholesaler will also see a 240% increase, resulting in an additional $12,000 expense. These increases can best be measured by the number of people who will be impacted. Businesses will be put in a situation of delaying hiring, deferring wages, or delaying other investments in their businesses due to these significant increases. We urge you to act quickly and support House Bill 2728. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkie. The next person is Ms. Shorthost. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lauren Shorthost, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm speaking today on behalf of the more than 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees that we represent. The Chamber Federation, which represents more than 43 local chambers and 21,000 businesses. The Minnesota Manufacturers Coalition, which represents a wide range of individual manufacturing associations across the state. And the United for Jobs Coalition, which represents nearly 80 organizations and their hundreds of thousands of employees. I've been joined by some of those colleagues and businesses here today. We are here to ask that the legislature take immediate steps to stabilize and restore Minnesota's UI trust fund to solvency and hold Minnesota businesses harmless from the double-digit UI payroll tax increases associated with the COVID-19 pandemic that are due in just a few short weeks and are based on a statute and a formula that was established long before the pandemic completely upended the system in significantly non-traditional ways. You've heard stories today about what these payroll tax increases actually look like.
One organization in the Twin Cities with less than 50 employees will see a 53% increase. An engineering firm in the seven county metro area will see a 90,000 increase in their UI assessment from what they are currently paying. And an excavating company in Greater Minnesota that already pays over $100,000 into the unemployment insurance system each year will see their UI bill go up by tens of thousands of dollars. Private sector businesses are Minnesota's economic engine, providing opportunity and quality of life for citizens across our state. They have weathered a nearly two-year storm of constant uncertainty, taking every step possible to keep their businesses afloat and their employees and customers healthy and safe and employed. They grapple with disrupted supply chains, inflation, and the worst workforce shortage in a generation. Employers statewide are in fierce competition for workers, which means they are already increasing wages, enhancing benefits, providing things like tuition assistance, training, professional development, offering greater employee flexibility, remote work, and childcare. Subsidies, signing bonuses, and more. Double-digit payroll tax increases make offering those enhancements and hiring more workers that much harder. This is entirely avoidable. With the benefit of our budget surplus and unspent federal relief funds, Minnesota can finally do what over half of the other states have already done, replenish unemployment trust funds so businesses can focus their resources on making sure they're staying open, rebuilding and rehiring, and growing. But time is of the essence. We appreciate that we are all here today and the recognition that the fixing the unemployment insurance is a priority. This fix is critical as we work to create economic opportunity and a full recovery. A complete and a clean bill that works to prevent these payroll tax increases should be among the first orders of business for the legislature, not held over for inclusion into an end of session omnibus. That is why we support the bipartisan approach put forth by Representatives Haley and Pawlowski, Governor Walz, Senate Jobs Committee Chairman Pratt, and Deed. These efforts, because they support workers, they support businesses, and benefit our entire economy. Thank you.
Thank you. I see we have on the other bill, Eric Harris-Bernstein, if you can introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, Chair and Nora, members of the committee. My name is Eric Bernstein. I'm policy director for We Make Minnesota, which is a coalition of community and labor groups organizing for a more just and equitable Minnesota. Thanks for having me here today. As you noted, I was going to testify in favor of your bill, which offers a welcome balance between trust fund repayment, tax rate stabilization, and the overall fairness of our unemployment insurance system. We're particularly enthusiastic, as many others have been, about the proposal to extend UI benefits to seasonal workers, which is long overdue. Universities and school districts across the state are struggling to hire and retain bus drivers, janitors, and cafeteria workers, largely because the positions require 3 months of unpaid leave every year. Allowing these workers to collect unemployment when needed is one of the most obvious steps to addressing the education staffing crisis, and we hope that this proposal will be incorporated into all UI relief legislation moving forward. But the other portions of this bill are a little harder to justify, although they're preferable to other proposals on the table. Some businesses and business interest groups have asked that the state abandon its agreed upon mechanism for trust fund repayment and instead use public dollars to cover their tax liabilities. That's not surprising, but I'm not sure why it's being taken so seriously. A UI tax cut will not benefit working Minnesotans, and it will not address the many pressing crises facing our state. Usually the demand for a corporate tax cut is tied to job creation, but jobs are plentiful right now. And in fact, as many today have testified, workers and business owners, the major economic challenge we face is a worker shortage, which results from underinvestment in the physical and social infrastructure that Minnesotans rely on to access the labor market. Ironically, the needed investments in transit, childcare, and paid leave are exactly those threatened if we spend our surplus on corporate handouts. Money in a business owner's pocket can be a very good thing, but in this case, the winners aren't those who need our help most. Approximating based on total private sector employment, firms with more than 500 workers would receive nearly half of a UI bailout, while those with nine or fewer workers would receive less than 10%. Scheduled UI tax increases sound large when stated as a percentage of current liabilities or when stated without context of total revenues or payroll. But UI taxes are a relatively small line item. In 2019, the average tax rate on total wages was 0.54%. That's $6.17 on an average weekly wage of $1,143. In this instance, the 30% increase Commissioner Grove referenced would mean an additional $1.85 per worker per week. Minnesota's largest corporations with thousands of employees will pocket millions, while the average small business would save a few bucks. Major multinationals like Walmart and Home Depot will also win seven-figure sums, and this money won't even stay in Minnesota. Rather, it will accrue as increased profits for shareholders and executives around the world. All this is to say that it is really unclear what benefit regular Minnesotans should expect to receive from this unprecedented use of billions of dollars of public funds. With the nation's worst housing shortage and some of its worst racial disparities, as well as the labor crisis that has been discussed today, I'd urge the committee to think honestly about the trade-off between an unemployment insurance bailout and the many other potential uses for this money. Chair Knorr's bill offers a reasonable middle ground that would minimize rate increases and negate the need for federal interest payments while preserving more than $1.5 billion in state funds compared to other bills heard today. I think that could be viewed as a very generous compromise, and I would urge the committee to consider it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll go to Jamie Farr and also the rest of the testifiers. Please make it short before we conclude in next 2 to 3 minutes. Go ahead, Ms. Farr.
Thank you, Chair Norman. Members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association. Minnesota has a very unique culture with hundreds of grocers and convenience stores, many of whom are independent, multi-generational, and locally owned. We are their trade association. We have over 300 members with 1,300 locations statewide, as well as food producers, manufacturers, brokers, and wholesale members. Our industry provides over 150,000 jobs in the state, both union and non-union. I want to thank Representative Haley, Representative Kututha-Wathun, and Chair Knorr, the entire committee, for taking the time to have this thoughtful discussion and bring forward House File 2728. We greatly appreciate Representative Haley's leadership in addressing this $2.7 billion deficit in Minnesota's Unemployment Trust Fund. We support this legislation. And we also appreciate the Governor and Deed's approach to this as well. As an industry that has been serving our communities since the beginning of this pandemic, and we continue to navigate historic challenges. In labor shortages, supply chains, disruptions, and inflation, this issue does need to be addressed. The challenges that we faced when COVID started with unemployment, with workers not being able to know what to do, and pure fear, having this opportunity for our workforce was critically important. The decisions made by federal and state governments are part of the reason that we have ended up in this deficit, and we do need to address it. We are hearing from our members that there is over a hundreds of percent of increase. We have one workforce, 3,000 employees, and they are going to see a 240% increase in their unemployment experience, ratings, and costs. This is accumulation, again, of our state and federal mandates directly related to the pandemic. Passage and advancement of this bill will ensure the fund has solvency and can rebuild for the future. I should think it should be clear that this is not a tax break. This is not something coming back into our pockets. Employers will pay their unemployment taxes as they have in the past, and they always will. We are asking that the pandemic portion of this be replenished. Again, this should be addressed. We greatly appreciate Chair Knorr, Representative Haley, and Representative Kututha-Wathun, and the committee for your immediate retention in resolving this issue. It does benefit workers and businesses all across the state. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts and are always here for conversation and to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jamie Poole, for your testimony. I will allow a few seconds from Danny Schwartzman, and we will conclude the meeting soon. We need to be done within the next minute. Go ahead, Danny. We will have another day to have a discussion on my bill.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. I really appreciate your balanced suggestion of restoring funds necessary to avoid federal interest payments. I run a business with now 20 employees. We had 50 before the pandemic. We had 8 at the low of the pandemic. Very, very difficult times. It's a restaurant and catering company in Minneapolis. I'm also a leader in the Main Street Alliance. We're working with businesses across the state. And for me, there's just a profound lack of focus in this bill. And then this general presentation about this issue set that we hear from large business groups primarily. My business has a UI tax rate for next year of 0.78%. The 15.8% assessment that is being proposed for my business will increase a tax of 0.12% of wages. It's real money. It's not worth billions of dollars of state funds to try and preserve and prevent that kind of increase. It would be much, much better if we see state funds used to target at businesses that need it the most. We cannot do that through this tool, but we have so many other tools at our disposal to do that. And I'd love to see investment in all the other things that we need, like direct supports for businesses that are most in need, like pandemic-related supports, like increased testing in our communities so that we can actually have more employees who can work, and we confront a problem of lack of access to people who can work because of a still raging pandemic. And this year, we're seeing an end to federal supports. So we don't have things like support for employees who are out sick because of the pandemic that we had before. Those are gone. So now we have employees who are forced to choose between coming to work sick, which we don't allow, not getting paid, our businesses paying expenses we can't afford because of tremendous decreases in sales to try and pay people to not work. We need a new programs on all these kinds of much more important issues. And this is not the key thing that most businesses are facing. We face profound challenges in our communities. Let's focus on the profound challenges and not on a relatively small cut in taxes for primarily to the largest businesses. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Danny. To Representative Haley, I think if you wanted to conclude, then renew your motion because we are out of time.
I renew my motion for House File 2728 that has bipartisan support and support from the governor and also Deed. And I renew my commitment to Deed to work on any technical language needed to get this done in a timely fashion so employees and employers are helped. Thank you, Chair Noor.
Thank you so much, Representative Haley. Renews our motion for House File 2728 as amended for possible inclusion in jobs bill. So with that, members, we have more to discuss. My bill is just plain. It reduces the debt, it removes any special assessment, no future tax credit, and it's the best option that we need to be looking at. So we adjourned with no further any discussion. So we'll see you Tuesday at the U of M, and then Wednesday we've got other discussions. So looking forward to seeing you all at the University of Minnesota for the Early Childcare Program. Thank you.